seated. Okay, the second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Petroleum Release Compensation Fund, appellant versus BP America and others, appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Matthew Herman, an attorney from Geneva, Illinois, and Ms. Judith Ziegler-Werkamp, an attorney from Harrisburg. And I understand, Mr. Herman, this morning you will be presenting, sir?
Yes.
All right. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Jeffrey Collins, an attorney from Rapid City, Mr. David Zott, and Mr. Daniel Siegfried, attorneys from Chicago, Illinois. And I understand, Mr. Zott, you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
All right. A little different lineup this morning. Justice Devaney has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Susan Sabers, a judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Devaney's place. And also, unfortunately, we had an injury on a member of the court. He injured his Achilles tendon, and he is with us by phone. So, Justice Salter, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning. Thank you.
Okay. So, that is how we will proceed. And he can hear counsel, and counsel can hear him. So with that, we will proceed. And Mr. Herman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Again, I am Matthew Herman, representing the appellant, the State of South Dakota, and the South Dakota Petroleum Release Compensation Fund, sometimes we refer to as PRCF. First, I wanted to start by thanking the court. As you said, I'm from Geneva, Illinois, and I was admitted pro hoc vice, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Before you, what I would like to start with is a short little chronological background and some facts that I think are important to the arguments that I need to make today. So we're going to start back in about 1990 when BP makes its first application to the fund for cleanup costs. And as we've outlined in our briefs, as part of the application process, the applicant submits a letter indicating whether or not they have insurance, and they execute subrogation assignments. The subrogation assignments are important to the PRCF in this case because those subrogation assignments transfer and subrogate to the PRCF all the rights, claims, interests, and rights of action which the undersigned, being the applicant, may have against any party, person, property, or corporation, including insurers, for the loss. The subrogation assignments also, importantly, warrant and represent that no settlement has been made by the applicant with any party, person, or corporation against whom a claim might lie, and no release has been given to anyone responsible for the cost of the cleanup, and that no such settlement will be made nor release given by the applicant without the written consent of the PCRF. So each time BP or anyone makes an application to the fund, they execute those subrogation assignments. So continuing forward to 1992, BP continues to make about 14 or 15 claims with the fund in that year, again, submitting the no insurance letters and executing the subrogation assignments. What happens in 1993 is BP institutes a lawsuit out in Chicago that we've referred as the Lloyd's litigation, where they sue their insurers seeking environmental costs. When the suit is filed, it only relates to what I'll call big ticket items, refineries, and things of the like. So the lawsuit originally included high exposure sites, refineries, chemical plants, where what happens is that lawsuit transforms into a situation where the insurers say, we want to buy back all the rights under the policies. We don't want to deal with just the refineries and the big chemical plants. But meanwhile, BP continues to make claims against the fund in 94, 95, 96. In 1996, because of the insurer's position with respect to that Lloyd's litigation, Amoco, they hire the outside attorneys, consultants, and environmental experts to engage in settlement discussions in parallel with the litigation that's going on. And that's where we get to the documents that frankly are the crux of what we of our case, which is the settlement report that they had put together by Arthur Anderson. It's the nine chapter, over 1,000-page report, which outlines all of the potential exposures they felt they had. And included in that report is Chapter 5, their marketing system, which includes underground storage tanks, and wherein they claim they have exposure for underground storage tank releases from 1959 through 1985. Now, also in these, when I talk about the settlement documents, there are basically three documents. There are, BP eventually settles that litigation with its insurers for close to $200 million and releases all claims available under any of the policies, which everyone agrees includes underground storage tanks, were released. Now, so we have the settlement agreements themselves with the insurers. We have the settlement proposals that went back and forth between the negotiation team and the insurers, where they came up with the essentially the very arguments we're making here today. Back then, the insurers said, you don't have coverage for that. You don't have coverage for underground storage tanks. And they, through coverage counsel and their consultants, came up with reasons why they did have coverage. That's where this, the one, I'm sure the court's familiar with the one occurrence theory that they advanced to get over the high SIRs. There were various disputes about the types of pollution exclusions, and they put together proposals on how they could defeat those as well. Now, this all occurs in 1997 and 98, despite the subrogation assignments, and admittedly, no one ever told the PRCF that these negotiations were going on, that UST claims were going to be released, or that, in fact, they ever recovered any money. So when the BP also makes a claim against the fund in 2002. So throughout, before, after, and during the settlement negotiations, BP represented that there would be no settlements of UST claims. And if a claim might lie, it was ours, and that then no release would be given without our consent. When the PRCF finds out about this in 2000, or the late, in the 2009 timeframe, we end up filing suit in 2010. And we brought several counts. Count one was for some rights under the statute. Two was for violation of the subrogation assignments. Count three, unjust enrichment. Four, fraud, fraudulent concealment and misrep. Count five, fraud. Count six, strict liability. And count seven, recovery of litigation counts. The trial court denied or granted judgment in favor of BP in two separate motion for summary judgment orders. We've appealed those orders. The standard of review with respect to those orders would be de novo. We also appealed the court's denial or exclusion of all the settlement documents, which is discretionary and subject to an abuse of discretion review. And we also appealed a discovery order that, if I have time to get to, I will, but that would also be subject to an abuse of discretion review.
So, counsel, aside from your expert's report, where in the record is there a policy that would have offered coverage for any of the 27 UST sites? Aside from the expert's report, do you have any policy that you can point to that provides coverage for the 27 sites?
Short answer is no, but that assumes that the settlement reports themselves are excluded. Obviously, BP made the argument that there was coverage, and respectfully, I believe the real issue is in 1997 and 1998, when these negotiations were ongoing, did those policies provide value? Not whether there was coverage or not, because we've had 20 years of law since then that, and I can talk about that briefly. If you look at the cases the court used to decide there was no coverage, she relies on a case from Alaska in 2008, which was an issue of first impression in 2008 as to whether or not gas was a pollutant under Alaska law. She relies on a case in South Dakota in 2011. But again, was a case of first impression as to whether or not the meaning of a sudden and accidental pollution exclusion had a temporal time frame to it, and also a case from South Dakota in 2000 about whether or not cement dust was a pollutant. So when these negotiations are going on in 1997, 1998, the issue really is, may a claim lie? And I would submit, yes, a claim may lie because they made it. They put together the settlement proposals. They put together the whole report saying, here's our exposures. If you want to buy it back, here's what's potentially out there. Here's what you could be liable for. So a claim, in fact, did lie because we saw them make it. And we know it has value because the undisputed testimony is that the insurers wouldn't have settled without it. And if the insurers wouldn't have settled without it, then it had to have value. And I think,
as I understand it, they wouldn't have settled without buying back the policies. In other words, they paid something for whatever the cost of these policies were, or whatever the premiums were, however they ended up valuing that. But that's different than what you're talking about in terms of placing a value on the actual potential liability, isn't it?
I'm not sure that it is, Justice.
Okay, tell me why.
Because of the release. The release language released all claims that could be made under the policy. It didn't say we're going to pretend like the policy never existed and here's your premium back and we're all going to go away. Let's be happy. It released any claim that could have been potentially made. And I would submit that the insurance companies, given the state of the law back then and some of the cases of first impression that I just referred to, didn't want to deal with those outcomes on a nationwide basis. And that is why they said, we want everything bought back once and for all. And in fact, they said if someone like us in the settlement agreements came in and made a claim, that the insurance companies were just going to tender it back to them because they indemnified the insurance companies if we did come forward and make a claim. So, I mean, if it didn't have value, then it would have been very easy to carve out. We're not releasing any claims for anybody related to marketing systems. Then it's over, but that's not what they did. They released all the claims. And that's why, frankly, I think our case hinges on the admission of the settlement documents, because without the settlements themselves, the settlement documents, and the proposals, we don't have much to point to, quite frankly. And I think the trial court abused its discretion in that regard, and I'd like to talk about that briefly. Here we have a somewhat unique situation in that the settlement agreement itself is a breach of the subrogation assignment. It's them releasing all UST claims that they previously assigned to us without our consent or approval. And there are a few cases, one of them being the C&E Service Inc. versus Ashland case that the court discussed, did say that it was the most analogous case, but Judge Devaney, now Justice Devaney, held that she would have ruled otherwise and disagreed with that case. But the importance of that case to us was that the court allowed the evidence's admission to prove an alleged fraud by a party to the negotiation. And that's what we're trying to do here. Them telling us that they had no insurance and executing the subrogation assignments and then telling the insurers that that there was coverage. There's also the case from South Dakota, Larson Manufacturing of South Dakota versus the Connecticut Green Star Inc., which again involved fraud. And the court said, quote, plaintiff's allegation and attachment of the PowerPoint presentation fall within the fraud exception to Rule 408. And the motion to dismiss the fraud cause of action is denied. And lastly, a case from Michigan about the ability to kind of use 408 as a sword and a shield. The court said, the application of an estoppel exception to Rule 408 is quite consistent with its goal of encouraging settlement, as it's difficult to understand how protecting fraud and deception will in any way advance the party's confidence in the settlement process. And I submit to the court that that's exactly what is being done here. They took money from the PRCF, attesting that they had no insurance coverage for UST leaks. They assigned all the rights to the insurance coverage to the PRCF. They promised that it would not make any settlement against anyone whom a claim, again, may lie. And unbeknownst to us, they sued their insurers, claimed they had coverage for those leaks, and then ultimately reached unallocated settlements for hundreds of millions of dollars. When I say unallocated, they're going to say that we only settled the refineries. They put together their nine-chapter presentation, and as I said, some of them were refineries. Chapter 5 was the marketing system, was USTs. They didn't allocate the actual settlements and say we're only settling the refinery portion.
Now, your presentation to the court today has been heavily focused on the facts of what happened. What do you think is the fundamental flaw the trial court made in ruling against you?
The non-admission of the settlement documents, which create questions of fact as to the remaining counts, because when those counts come, when we deal with the elements of those counts, the court said essentially there was no fraud because they didn't have coverage. And the fundamental mistake was the issue isn't whether or not there's coverage today. The issue is whether or not that those claims had value when they were released.
Well, I want to ask you about Rule 408, though.
Sure.
Let's assume that it should have come in.
Okay.
Didn't the court ultimately consider, I mean, it looks like as I review the ruling, she went through all the the settlement documents. She went through the settlement report. She said, yeah, I don't think it's admissible, but I'm going to look and see if there's any material facts. So does 408 really matter in this case?
I think it does, because respectfully, I've read that opinion many times, and I couldn't find one inference in it that was drawn in our favor. And I think that, given that that was the stage of summary judgment, when the insurers say we won't settle unless everything's included, including underground storage tanks, then the inference to be drawn is it has value. Now, what value it has? Again, a question of fact. And I think that's why these, I spent so much time on this, because without 408 and the arguments that they made therein, that's where the questions of fact come from. And respectfully, the judge gave them the 408 issue both ways, in that you need a disputed claim in the underlying settlement. And Judge Devaney applied rule of 408, necessarily saying, okay, there was a disputed claim regarding UST tanks in the underlying Amoco litigation, and then says, well, I'll look at the documents, and then I decide the settlement had nothing to do with UST tanks. Those two are inconsistent and do not go together, and that's why I believe the rule 408 is the most crucial issue in this case. And when we get to have the fact that value was available and should have been construed in our favor, and I think that allows the other causes of action to survive.
Mr. Herman, sorry to interrupt, but don't we review a trial court's determination under the rules of evidence differently than we would its decision to grant a motion for summary judgment at Rule 56? In other words, if your argument is that Judge Devaney's evidentiary ruling should somehow fold in and contemplate the Rule 56 standard, I'm interested in hearing how that works.
If I may continue. Just
go ahead and answer.
I still think it's an abuse of discretion standard. If I get over the hurdle that says that she abused her discretion in excluding the evidence, then I think the standards of now with that evidence in, what has to be viewed in the light most favorable to us, which I think then carries the day on summary judgment.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Zott, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, it's an honor to be here today. Summary judgment was properly granted in this case because of the state's fundamental and pervasive failure to meet their burden of proof. The core claim in this case is whether Amoco had insurance that covered the same costs that the fund reimbursed and therefore misrepresented to the state when it said it was self-insured. The question of Amoco's insurance coverage is a pure question of law. No one has ever claimed that any of these policies are ambiguous. And so it's a question that must, in fact, be decided by the court as a matter of law on summary judgment. It's also a yes or no question. It's not a question of there may have been insurance or there might have been insurance. You either have it or you don't. The circuit court correctly granted Amoco summary judgment because the plaintiff failed in its burden of showing that any insurance policy covered any of the releases at issue. They never made that showing below. They never made that showing today. In fact, Justice Kern, in response to your question, which is, can you identify a policy that covers any of the releases at issue? The answer was no. And frankly, that ends the case. I mean, if you don't have insurance coverage, then each of their claims falls of its own weight, as the Circuit Court, now Justice Devaney, carefully considered. Now, all the arguments and all the arguments we heard today are really an effort through the use of extrinsic evidence outside of the insurance policies, subrogation, which I'll talk about, are really an effort to evade the burden that they had to come forward with proof that there was insurance coverage. So although they have not talked about the policies, I'm going to spend just 2 minutes on them because the circuit court did exhaustively analyze the policies and conclude that they did not provide coverage. There were two sets of policies that the expert identified that you alluded to. The traveler's policy, which was in place from 74 to 77, and a set of Lloyd's policies in place from 72 to 1986. The first core problem with their insurance argument is just a timing disconnect. The earliest reported release was in 1987, but the last policy expired in 1986. And so for that reason alone, there was no possible insurance coverage. Beyond that, the court then looked at the individual policies and concluded that the traveler's policy, which expired 10 years before the first release at issue here, also was a unique policy that only applied to injuries caused by Amico's agents or to the premises owned by Amico's agents. And there's never been any showing that that unusual factual scenario applied to any of these claims. In fact, in the argument, you may have seen the court ask, can you identify a single release or a single policy that applied to, to a single release that triggered the traveler's policy? And they said, no, they could not do that. And that's exactly the same answer you got here. Then with the Lloyd's policies, in addition to the timing issue, there's the two other problems. One's the math problem, where those policies had a $5 million self-insured retention. They weren't triggered until you hit that. But the most that the fund could reimburse was $1 million. The most it actually reimbursed was $677,000. There's also an exclusion that was instituted in these policies in 1985 called the absolute pollution exclusion. And the court, reviewing that, concluded unambiguously and as a matter of law, it barred and excluded any recovery for losses from cleaning up pollution like petroleum. Leaking petroleum. And once again, the earliest release was in 1987. The absolute pollution exclusion applied. That would have barred coverage as well. So for those reasons, each count of their complaint, leaving aside this indirect, count six, fails as a matter of law because there was no insurance and no misrepresentation. Let me address the subrogation issue. As the circuit court correctly held, for subrogation, the state steps into the shoes of Amico. And the only way that there could be a breach of the subrogation agreement is if Amico, in fact, had insurance. Because if Amico had no insurance, then the release of those policies through the settlement did not in any way harm the state. And the court cited to the Iowa Supreme Court case, the Hykens case, which discusses this very issue, which is what do you have to show for a breach of a subrogation agreement? And you need to show that you would recover under the underlying insurance policies. And here, the answer to that is they would not have because there was no insurance. They claim that Amico misrepresented in the subrogation agreement. The representation there was that Amico did not settle with someone against whom a claim might lie for the cleanup or release anyone who would be responsible for the cleanup. But as the circuit court held, that just circles right back to the question of insurance. No claim may lie against the insurers because there's no insurance coverage as a matter of law. Therefore, there was no misrepresentation. And what they're really trying to do here, and I'm going to address this next, is they're trying to bootstrap. What they want to do is use the settlement evidence to try to establish coverage and say, because of the position you took in settlement, there must be coverage, and therefore you must have made a misrepresentation. But that is precluded by several legal doctrines, including the fact that Rule 408 expressly bars it. So I'm going to turn then to that issue, which is the what counsel said is the central issue for them, the exclusion of this settlement evidence. Now, the first issue, the first reason the court correctly excluded that evidence is because the insurance policies are plain and unambiguous, and therefore no extrinsic evidence is admissible to alter or supplement their plain terms. That's what the court held, and you can see that in footnote 15 of the opinion. They never challenged that ruling. They've waived it on appeal. So for that reason alone, you don't even have to walk down the path of Rule 408 because it's extrinsic evidence that would vary the unambiguous terms of the policies. The court then did address Rule 408 and correctly held that Rule 408 bars their proposed use of this evidence. And that is, as was noted, an abuse of discretion standard. So the question obviously isn't whether any one of your honors would have made the same decision, but whether any reasonable court could have made that decision. Here, the judge was exactly right in excluding the evidence because they proposed to use the evidence in exactly the way that Rule 408 prohibits. And I think we heard that this morning. They want to use that insurance, those settlement discussions, to say that because Amoco asserted coverage there, they can use that to try to establish liability for coverage here. And that's exactly what the rule says you can't do, because the whole point is you should have freedom in settlement negotiations to take positions that aren't necessarily legally correct, that may be legally unfounded, without fear that then later you'll be hauled into court and have those statements come back and be used to establish liability, which is exactly what they're doing here. They make a number of arguments to try to escape Rule 408. We've addressed them all in our brief. I'll just sort of touch on a couple that I think that they try to emphasize in the argument here today. The first is they've argued below, and I think they hinted here, that there may be a different claim, that Rule 408 only applies to the claim that's the subject of the settlement. But that the court considered all of these arguments, incidentally, and carefully considered and rejected them. But what they disregard is the case from this court, the first Premier case, where the court looked at a similar situation and said that the Rule 408 applies equally if the plaintiff is attempting to introduce evidence of a defendant's settlement with a third party in order to establish its claim. And that was the facts of first Premier. It's exactly the same situation here. And yet, other than citing that case in their statement of the case, they don't discuss it or attempt to distinguish it at all. And that case is dispositive. In fact, the court there held it was plain error to admit the evidence, to admit the Rule 408 evidence. Beyond that, there's not a different claim. It's exactly the same claim. It's the same insurance claims, the same policies, the same parties to the insurance agreements, the same arguments about exclusion at issue in this case. They talked here earlier about the fraud exception. And it is true that where the parties to the settlement negotiation, if they committed fraud or made a misrepresentation, then that could be the basis for a claim, and the settlement wouldn't bar that. But that's talking about a misconduct in the settlement negotiations between the two settling parties. That's not what we're talking about here. The insurers have never claimed that Amoco did anything wrong, because Amoco did nothing wrong. So that has nothing to do with trying to use settlement evidence to prove liability because of the fact of settlement or what was said during settlement. The C&E case that they mentioned. First, I submit it can't be an abuse of discretion for the court to refuse to follow a non-binding out-of-state decision when its decision is fully supported by the plain language of Rule 408 and by this court's own decision in the first Premier case. I also note we cite two other cases from, if we're going to look to out-of-state decisions, Minnesota and Ohio. Both of those cases considered exactly these policies between the same parties, exactly the same claims and arguments that were made here, and excluded the evidence under Rule 408. In any event, that CNA case is also distinguishable. That case allowed a very limited reference to a settlement to prove a misrepresentation. It didn't involve the issue of extrinsic evidence to alter the meaning of unambiguous contracts, which is what we have here. And the court cautioned, though, that you could not use the evidence to try to establish liability. But here they just said that they're not talking about a limited or isolated use. They said that's their whole case. And without that case, they have nothing. And even the CNA court, if you read that, would never have allowed the introduction of the evidence in that context when that's your whole case. The alternative argument then, and Justice Jensen, this is the issue that you referred to, which is even assuming the court were incorrect in admitting the evidence, which we don't believe the court was incorrect, was it actually harmful in any way? Because the court actually then went and looked at the evidence to see whether or not it showed that there was any value paid for underground storage tanks. And there's a big difference between their argument is just there was a global release. The insurers wanted to, if they were going to settle any kind of coverage litigation, they wanted complete peace. They didn't want any claim to ever come back, whether it was covered by insurance or it wasn't covered by insurance. But there's a big difference between insisting on a global release and paying value for any conceivable claim, even if it wasn't covered by insurance. And what the court did is it looked to all the evidence in the record, and it found that on the undisputed evidence, no value was paid for underground storage tanks. It's not a question of failing to make inferences in the favor of the state. They just cited no evidence that showed that any value was paid, and all the evidence was to the contrary. So both of the lead negotiators in that settlement, Mr. Teff for the Lloyd's of London and Mr. Hargis for Amoco, testified that no value was paid. Mr. Teff, the Lloyd's person, in fact, testified that he had no ability to pay value for underground storage tanks because the lawsuit, as they recognized, only covered these major sites, these major refineries and chemical plants, and asserted insurance coverage. He reserved on that basis. And he said he only had the money to pay out of the reserves. So literally, there was no ability to pay for underground storage tanks, as the court correctly found. The circuit court also noted there's a total disconnect between those settlements and the claims here, because those settlements were limited to exposure pre-June 1985. Because at that point, there was the absolute pollution exclusion, and no one, even in a settlement context, is going to argue that there was any coverage. And yet here, the first reimbursed release was 2 years later in 1987. So there's really no even overlap between the what was discussed in those settlements and the claim being made in this case. So that really takes care of counts one through counts five. I'm going to just briefly, although it was not addressed here today, it may in reply, so let me just touch briefly on the indirect claim, which is count six. This is sort of an unprecedented claim that Amoco should be held liable for sites that it formerly owned when the state determined that someone else, the successor, was responsible for the cleanup. The successor actually cleaned up the property. The successor applied to the fund for reimbursement. The state determined the successor was responsible, ultimately paid the successor, and now they say they should be able to come back and sue Amoco for some portion of that cleanup. And the court granted summary judgment on all but one claim on statute of limitations, and then the final one site on the merits. As a threshold matter, the court held that because the department determined that the successor was the responsible party, only the department could change that determination in the first instance, that the court really doesn't have the power to say, just to jump in and say, well, yeah, it's fine, Amoco is responsible, even though you administratively determined someone else was responsible. And that was based on the court's statutory reading of the two provisions, 34A, 12, 16, and 14. If you read them together, it makes clear that the state has to determine in the first instance the responsible party. They at no point ever said Amoco is responsible. They don't challenge that issue on appeal. That alone wipes out all of count six because they don't challenge the court on that, and that's a waiver. beyond that, the court was correct on the statute of limitations. As this court knows based on the precedents, the circuit court held that the cause of action here accrued when the state knew or should have known about the release that caused damage. Here, there's no dispute that all the releases were expressly reported to the state more than 6 years, except for one, more than 6 years prior to the complaint. Not only did that put the state on notice, but they actually have an affirmative statutory duty to determine the responsible party. And they, in fact, did that and determined that someone else was responsible. So that was the triggering date for the statute of limitations. The court was correct about that. That bars all but one of the claims. The East Lutheran case that they rely on was later distinguished in the Gaddis case. And the issue with East Lutheran is there was actually two causes of action. And the question was whether knowledge of one problem was sufficient to trigger knowledge of a different problem. And Gaddis said, well, there's only one issue. As in our case, there's only one issue, which is the leaking underground storage tanks. The issue is when did you have actual constructive notice? lastly, just cite 6167. All I'll say about that is it's the same issue as I started with, just a fundamental failure of proof. The state, after having determined that the successor was responsible, would like to now say that Amoco is responsible, and there's simply no evidence in the record of that. In fact, after conducting a full investigation, the state determined that the leaks were from the underground storage tanks of the successor, not Amoco, and they don't challenge that in any way. In fact, they say that they were correct. This is at the opinion, page 30. The court cites the fact that they maintain, the state maintains they were absolutely correct in determining that the successor was responsible. There's no evidence that Amoco was responsible. So unless if there are further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Well, in South Dakota, nobody is ever chastised for quitting early.
Well, thank you very much. I, again, very much appreciate being here.
Thank
today.
You, Mr. Zach. Mr. Herman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the 408 issue real quick and kind of give a practical example of why I believe the way they are invoking the rule is improper. And you can take a simple car accident case. If I get in a car accident, my car gets damaged. My insurer repairs it, let's say, for $7,500. And now my insurer has subrogation rights to try to collect that money from someone who might be responsible, the person I was involved in the accident with. So let's assume I was also injured in the case. I go and file a tort case. I file a case for personal injury. And I give the tortfeasor a complete release, don't protect the subrogation rights of the insurance company, and release any claims that anyone might have had against the insurance company, against that tortfeasor or their insurance company. Of course, my insurance company is going to come to me and say, you just breached your subrogation rights. But if BP is correct, I say, well, you can't prove it. I did it in the settlement agreement. And that's what settlement agreements allow, for me to be free. And I think it's a double standard, and they're hiding behind the purpose of the rule. The purpose of the rule is to, has generally been, you don't want to have someone say something in settlement like, I'll offer you $10,000, and then allow the plaintiff to say, well, you already admitted to me you were liable because you offered me money. I mean, that's the purpose of the rule. The purpose of the rule isn't to allow contrary positions where you've made different attestations to different parties regarding the same subject matter. And briefly, you know, if the settlement, he talked about a time frame overlap, and there's evidence in the record from Mr. Ram that there are releases back in the 80s, prior to 85. What counsel was actually referring to is reported releases, which is different than actual releases. Mr. Hargis, their chief negotiator, took the position that tanks leaked from 59 to 85. Now, whether a release was reported or not is different than whether or not there were actual releases. So I think the...
Well, let me stab you there, though. Sure. But that's tanks nationwide, correct? They're talking about tanks not just in South Dakota, but
everywhere.
In all states.
Correct.
So is there any evidence in the record here that indicates or suggests that any of the, 27 sites that are at issue here leaked prior to reported data in 1987?
I believe that's part of Mr. Ram's report. That if you look at Table C, he's talking about the direct sites, and he's got their dates of operation, and it was his opinion that the tanks leaked since installed. Now, I will concede there wasn't a reported leak on those times, but Mr. Ram's report also in B is where he did all the ratios on the plumes and things like that and opined that there were releases prior to 1985. But the fact,
Mr. Herman,
yes.
Mr. Herman, can I interrupt? I'm sorry, forgive me. I may have a follow-up, too. Is your argument something like this? There may or may not be coverage, but there's an argument for coverage. And that's enough, in your view, to have a jury value the subrogated claims. Is that fair or not?
Yes, that is a fair characterization. And again, I tried to stress that. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So it seems to me if that's your argument, then are you saying, look, you know, we probably can't win outright, you know, dollar for, you know, 100 cents on the dollar with this coverage issue?
Well,
So we're going to ask a jury to somehow, what, value the discounted, subrogated claim as if you were trying to settle it back in 98?
That's possible, but that's where we made the argument regarding why the settlements were unallocated is important. And it's our position that if you, and we talked about it in several contexts, tax scenario, income versus non-income, some of the insurance policies where you have the different layers, that if the settlement is global and it's unallocated, it's presumed to be unallocated to protect or allow them to essentially have the double recovery and not pay us. So I think there are two arguments that could be made there. One, that it's unallocated and therefore we're entitled to it all. Two, what Justice, I believe it was Slater.
So that's me.
Had just mentioned. And three, I think we're entitled to argue that we're entitled to the money we paid them as a breach of the subrogation assignment. We gave them money in exchange for the subrogation assignment. And if a claim might have lied, then it was ours to make. It was ours to make that argument. It was ours to negotiate. And since they didn't abide by that, we should receive the money back in that regard. So don't you think
you have to really then endorse this one occurrence theory? Because that seems to me to be the principal way that you would navigate around the insurmountable, or what the trial court described as the insurmountable math problem.
Again, I'm not sure that we have to get around it to prove coverage. The issue from our perspective is in 1997 and 1998, when they're negotiating these claims, is there a possibility that you could win on that claim? And we would essentially switch positions with BP. We'd be making the arguments that BP made then, that they made to their insurers, and now they've slipped into their insurer's position and said there was no coverage, all of our arguments were basically worthless, we just did it to try to get the number up. And I submit those are the types of things that create questions of fact as to what they thought, what they believed in 1988. And that's why it's important that those documents come in, because once they come in, it gives us questions of fact that we can argue when it comes to the fraud, when it comes to the subrogation. I want to just briefly touch on the indirect site issue that counsel raised. And again, this comes back to the settlement reports. What they are saying in Chapter 5 is we have 60-some thousand service stations out there across the country. And 50%, I might have the numbers back, it's 50 or 25. They eventually say there's 8,155 or so sites out there that have leaked sometime between 1959 and 1985 that we don't know about yet, and we are expecting people to come back to us for coverage, and that's your potential exposure. So when they talk about whether we should have notice or not, I think that's very telling. They don't even know where these sites are. And to impute constructive notice on us in that situation, I think, is problematic, which kind of ties in with the sanctions order that I'll try to squeeze in here in the last minute. When this case was filed, we said, give us your footprint in 2005. Tell us where you did business, where you operated, where you leased, where you did business. And they said, we don't know. We don't have a list. And we litigated that issue for years. There were motions to compel. There was fights on the 30B6 notice, what the scope was. There were fights on production requests, and they repeatedly said, we don't maintain a list until we took their 30B6, their self-designated 30B6 representative, who was responsible for filling out the application forms. And she says, when I took the job in 1990, I was given a list of all the service stations in South Dakota and their channel of trade, which told us whether we owned them, leased them, or whatnot. But I destroyed it in 2015, despite knowing of a litigation hold. So my point is, the constructive notice issue, I think, is a hard argument for them to make when they themselves don't know where they operated, where the leaks were, but they want to charge us with notice once a leak occurs.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess.